Hey, Kelsey.
Hey, Brooke.
Want to tell everyone what's happening in today's episode?
Today, we're talking about the women of the Mongol Empire.
Great. I want to know.
Okay, awesome. You should know, Brooke. Women in this time period governed more land and people than ever before or since in world history.
Okay, let's get into this.
Hello, and welcome to Remedial Her Story, The Other 50%, the podcast that explores what happened to the women in history class. Now, here's your host, Kelsey Brooke Eckert, and her partner in crime, Brooke Neva Sullivan.
So, Brooke, we're going to do a two-part episode on the Mongolian Empire, because if that intro doesn't make it clear enough, this is an important period in women's history.
Kelsey's got big hand gestures and wide eyeballs, so I'm in. All right, let's figure this out.
Now, I don't know if you know this, but I have been to Mongolia.
I feel like I should have known that.
Yeah. So I was a sophomore in college, and I was a political science major, and someone said, hey, there's a political science study abroad going to Mongolia. Do you want to go? And I was like, sure. And if you'd asked me at the time, I would not have been able to point to Mongolia on a map.
Please don't ask me right now. I definitely don't think I could.
So if you can picture China, it has this nice curve at the top of it.
Yes.
And in that curve fits nicely a little country called Mongolia. It's not little. It's actually very big.
Yeah, no, country, I was going to say. I was like, Mongolia. I'm pretty sure it's a very large place.
And on the top, it is bordered by Russia. So its neighbors are China and Russia. And it has long histories with both of those empires.
It has its own empire as well.
Yes. So in the around 1200-ish, 1200 to 1400, it had the largest land-based empire in world history. And it expanded super rapidly under Genghis Khan. And
yes. Okay.
So he's the person who often comes into history class. You know, he's the Alexander the Great. He's the, you know, the person that people often hear about when they learn about the Mongol Empire. He is super crucial, and everything in Mongolia is named after him. I have flown in and out of Genghis Khan Airport. I've been to the Genghis Khan Hotel in downtown Ulaanbaatar. I've been to the Genghis Khan pub. I've been to the, you know, everything is Genghis Khan.
Apparently, so, he was a big deal.
He was a big deal. So, yeah. So, I went to Mongolia when I was 19 years old. And
that's quite the experience.
It was my first, other than like Canada and the Bahamas as a kid, I had never been outside of the country.
Canada and the Bahamas. All right.
And then Mongolia. And it was the best summer of my entire life.
So how long were you there for?
I was there for, I was abroad for 10 weeks. So we were on the trimester system, which is a little different than the semester system at my college. And so we spent a trimester abroad. We spent a week and a half on either end in China. So we flew into Beijing, and then we took a train from Beijing to the capital city of Ulaanbaatar. And it was an overnight train, because that's like a really far distance. I don't know what it would be like in the United States, but I don't know.
Like Maine to Florida.
Yeah. I'd be speculating. Someone can Google that. But it took us, so we left, you know, midday and maybe even morning. And then we slept on the train. So it was like a sleeper train.
Oh, fun.
And, but it was very, very scary. And I don't want to like introduce stereotypes that don't belong. Really, the problem was language barrier.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I just didn't understand what people were saying. It was probably very normal.
Well,
like,
you'd only ever been...
I'd only ever been to the Bahamas and Canada. And in Canada, everyone's like, hey! You
know? And maybe speaks French.
Right. So, at night, when we crossed the border into Mongolia, there were these like... It just felt like aggressive Chinese guards being like, give me your passport and blah, blah, blah. But they don't speak English, so they're yelling things at me.
You're also using your own understanding of borders that you've interacted with, too. Yeah. And, like, our border, at least from New Hampshire to Canada, is very low-key.
Yeah.
I mean, United States to Mexico is a little more aggressive, and there's a lot of guns and those sort of things. But, you know, it's that would be intense.
Yeah. So it was intimidating. I had just spent a week and a half in China. And Beijing, if you'd never, and this was the summer of 2007. So it was before the Olympics had been in Beijing. And that's kind of important because they did a lot of work to clean the city up and make it ready for a international audience in the years after that. Beijing was really gross. And you know, I was there for a week and a half. I didn't see blue sky once.
Whoa.
Just so smoggy. Everything just was covered in a layer of like coal. Was, you know, everything smelled different. And I also, you know, I grew up in rural New Hampshire and I didn't spend a lot of time in cities. And maybe if I had like been from New York City, it would have been a little bit more like the sewer smells and all that stuff, like might have been a little
you
bit.
You would have gotten used to the always smelling like hot dogs. Yeah. Every time we go to New York, like growing up, it'd be like, there it is, the hot dog smell.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You know, but like everything about China was really different. I also got very sick there from food and you couldn't drink water.
You're also an incredibly picky eater. I'm a wildly picky eater.
So I had a really hard time.
Your poor chaperone.
I know. But I also like, I want to be there and I'm like down to try stuff, but then it like puts my gut in.
Tailspin.
So anyway, that's a me problem. Anyway, so I was having a really hard time and I kept being like, okay, so now we're going to go to a recovering ex-Soviet satellite nation that like is going to be like poorer. And we, you know, we had done a ton of research prior to this. And so I was like, what am I in for? And we're on this train.
How many white kids are on this trip?
Most of us. There were a few Asian and a few. Our school had a huge international population. Actually, 20% of the student body was international. So we had, you know, a student from Ghana with us, Ingrid. So anyway, it was, but mostly, you know, white kids like myself. And we definitely walking through the streets of China, we were a spectacle.
Oh, like, sure. Backpacks on tight, walking quickly in a line.
Oh, but like, I mean, my white face and green eyes, you could see me like 10 miles away. You know, like it was just like a walking spectacle.
Imagine if you were tall.
Well, so at one point I was walking down the street with my friend Rachel, who's probably 6 foot tall, blonde, blue eyes.
Oh, geez.
Ingrid, who's from Ghana, she had super dark skin, super dark hair, but she also had like braided it to have like red strands through it. So it also sort of like looked different. And then me with my like very curly brown hair and green eyes. And the three of us walking down the street together just looked like a, you know, like a clown show.
Celebrities.
Downtown Beijing. Anyway, so we're on the train and I'm like, I'll be honest, I'm like a week into this trip and I'm super stressed about what the next, because we're in Mongolia for the bulk of it, you know, and I'm like, what is this going to be like? And the sun rises the next morning, we're still on the train and I open the shades in our train car and I look out and it's just green pastures and cows and yaks and blue sky as far as the eye can see. And it was the first time I'd seen blue sky for a week. And I was just like, oh my God, this place is incredible. And I spend a little bit of time talking about the landscape because the Mongol people in Genghis Khan's time and today are nomadic, they're pastoralists, they follow their herds. And even today, in the 21st century, they live in these yurts, which are called gers, spelled G-E-R when sort of translated to the alphabet. And they travel around following, you know, the herd wherever it goes. In the 21st century, they have like satellite dishes and TVs inside. And it's like super cool to see, you know,
modern technology
in these gears. It's really neat. But yeah, that is them. And you know, the big slogan is blue sky, big blue sky and open air. Yeah. And the god that the Mongols worshipped in Genghis Khan's time was the blue sky, you know.
Oh.
And it's because it's everywhere. And at the time, this is funny for everybody who lives out west, but at the time I'd never been west of really like St. Louis in the United States. And I had never been to Colorado. I went to Colorado. I actually lived in Colorado later that winter. But the Mongolian landscape reminds me a lot of Colorado.
Oh,
now that I've been there, I'm like, oh, this is, and maybe even like parts of Utah and
yeah. Do you feel like it's because it's like more mountainous and
yeah, and arid, and so I just never been in a landscape like that. So at the time I was like, this is wild, and then I was like, oh, this is just like a normal thing.
That's awesome.
So Mongolia is, a really amazing place. It's my favorite place I've ever been. And if I could go back to a place, I probably won't ever go back to a place that I've already been just because there's so many places in the world to go. But if I could go back to a place, it would be Mongolia for sure.
Okay.
And I've been like all over Europe, So it's incredible.
So tell us more about the history of Mongolia.
Yeah. So Genghis Khan is really the person who's at the center of the story. Mm-hmm. But why this is women's history is because of his lived experiences as a child that led him to have a really deep respect of women and women's abilities to govern. And I'm going to paraphrase here a little bit, but he said essentially, if you can maintain a home, an orderly home, then you can maintain an orderly territory. And so what people know about him is that he like really rapidly and violently conquered all of this land. And some people refer to it as sort of this like flash in the pan of conquering land, and then the empire kind of disappears pretty quickly, right? We don't spend a lot of time talking, we spend a ton of time on the Roman Empire, and this is infinitely bigger than the Roman Empire.
Right.
And it's because it was sort of short-lived. We're talking about a 200-year span here. But the empire fractures at points and whatnot. This is women's history because as the empire grows, he actually appoints his wives and his daughters to maintain the territory. And his view basically was women govern and men go to war. So he marries his daughters off to these, people that who are supposed to govern a certain territory, but he gives his daughter the title of princess, and he gives his son-in-law the title of son-in-law. And he says, now come with me, we're going to war. And often they would die and she would just marry somebody else a minute later, So it's kind of interesting. So backing up to Genghis Khan and where his deep respect for women comes from. And I think for this episode, we'll just focus on his childhood and story before the empire really becomes what it is. So for Khan, the whole story really actually starts with his parents. And there's a lot of like complicated family trees. So I'm going to try to like simplify the tree down a little
bit. Thank you. I appreciate that.
So his mom is betrothed to this guy, and they even get married, and they're like on their way to their like honeymoon essentially. And Genghis Khan's dad kidnaps her, steals her as his bride, and that's the end of that marriage. And so she is now married. She's now married to Genghis Khan. Khan's dad. Sorry. Genghis Khan is a title. Ruler of the empire. So his name's Temujin. And so his dad and his mom sort of get together in this like, I'm wife stealing over here way. Like very aggressive, right? He like steals the bride and like takes her to his camp. This is kind of representative of the sort of hostile nature of the clans in the Mongol steppe region. And and there's these like deep rivalries that aren't forgotten, right? So Temujin later, the dad dies. He's, he's kind of classic, like raised by a single mom guy. She has, four kids by his dad. He had two kids from a previous marriage that she's also raising. And I think along the way, she like adopted four others that like needed care. So this woman's just like the ultimate caregiver and like total rock star. At some point, they end up in slavery. He witnesses his mom being raped, and he himself, is put through like pretty brutal slave conditions. he escapes. He eventually is betrothed to be married to Borta, and she is, in the Mongol tradition, you marry, the man marries somebody from the mother's family. And so he's marrying a relative of his mom's side of the family. And it's a way of, like, in a weird way, it's like keeping these matriarchal lines together, which is kind of interesting, even though it's a pretty, like, male-dominated society. So he marries Borta, and at some point, Borta is captured away by that tribe, that clan that has, you know, anger against his family, right? Because of them stealing his mom, you know, that sort of thing. So he, like, gets his people together, and he goes and recaptures her. And one of the things that's kind of interesting, he ends up having a few sons through Borta, but the first child is disputed whether it's actually his, because she was of this theft, and because she was raped while in captivity. He accepts Jochi, this young man, into his life and raises him as his son. And his view was that if the child came out of his wife, it belonged to him, and he was responsible for it.
Snap.
So it didn't really, like, paternity didn't matter, because, like, he was married to Borta, and this is her son, and he's raising him.
Yeah. Okay.
So I thought that was just kind of an interesting flip on the typical narrative that we hear. Other members of the family always question this kid's paternity. Rude. And, you know, later it becomes problematic. But that sort of this really humble origin for probably one of the most significant people in world history, and the role that his mom sort of plays in that period, as this, like, solidifying figure, this woman, like, holding it together in a very dangerous, hostile landscape where people are getting stolen away, kidnapped, made to be slaves, that sort of thing, is, I think, just really important to understand about him. When he, and this is decades later, but he, you know, finally gets Borta to get back, and they start having children. He starts building these alliances. There's actually this really, like, low period where people are not with him, and he has to, you know, negotiate and try to get, kind of, like, work the tribes sort of against each other to rally people behind him. And when he finally establishes himself and is elected by the tribal communities as Genghis Khan, he lays some ground rules about how women are going to be treated. Oh. And I think that's kind of interesting, right? But one of the rules is, we're not going to kidnap them. Women are not going to be raped as a form of, like, punishment, right? Women are, you know, there's sort of this, like, baseline respect for women's leadership. And then obviously all the things about they get to govern. Inside the Ger, that was considered, like, women's territory. They rule in there. There's a story later on of a Khan who had, and polygamous marriage is really common in the Mongol society, but there's a story about this Khan taking a second younger, you know, an additional younger wife, and there's no ger for him to go with her on their wedding night. And so he, like, brings her into an older wife's ger, and she's like, get out. Like, this is my space. You can't, like, bring your younger wife in here.
Oh my God, that's amazing. And
so he, like, slept in the dirt with his new wife outside because she was like, not in my house, you know? And I think that's kind of, it just sort of shows, like, even though, you know, polygamy might be something that's, like, hard for a modern audience to understand, there also was, like, respect and power within the realm that belonged to her.
Yeah.
So this story only gets juicier from here.
I mean, I'm riveted.
Genghis Khan from here is, you know, now elected Khan by all the tribal communities, is going to conquer more territory than anybody else. The only thing that stops Khan and his sons from conquering the world is geography. What makes them incredibly successful is they are wildly proficient on horseback.
Oh.
And so anything that a horse can successfully cross, is theirs to for the taking. They basically get to the Himalayas and they go, oh, those mountains are really tall. They try to conquer Japan twice, but like horses aren't great on boats. They go into Europe and actually kind of the landscape, the watery sort of landscape was tricky for the horses to refuel and that sort of thing. So kind of in every direction that they go, there's sort of this geographic barrier that they encounter.
Interesting.
But anything that's in between there,
like mine.
Mine. Yeah. And at wherever they go, women are installed to govern what they've controlled.
Whoa.
Next episode, we're going to talk about the way those women, those specific women, will give you some names to work with. But we're also going to talk about, this sounds like, whoa, they just conquered a bunch of places. And yes, but one of the other things about them was they were horrifying for anybody like sitting inside a city. Well, like if you're in Baghdad, you should be like freaking out as you see the Mongol Empire coming. And because what that did also mean, despite his desire to not allow, you know, rape and all those sorts of things, these are invading armies.
Yeah.
And that was commonplace throughout the empire. And so we will be talking about some of that sexual violence. I also am going to call out two organizations in particular, but National Geographic, I'm coming for your coverage of Genghis Khan, as well as the History Channel, who on Valentine's Day twice released articles about Genghis Khan, the prolific lover.
Oh no.
Rape does not equal love, to be clear. So anyway, we'll be talking about those details in episode 2.
Awesome. I'm looking forward to it. Thanks, Kels.
See you next time.
See you next time.
Thanks so much for listening to Remedial Her Story, The Other 50%. Please subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to your podcasts to bring more voices to the conversation. We really appreciate that effort. Until next time.